Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. We talk about food. We talk about farming. We talk about recipes. We give advice and opinions. Welcome. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Donna is back. She was gone last week because she has lots to tell us about her most current adventures. Many people join in together and volunteer to help make this radio station happen. We couldn't do it without our underwriters, our volunteers, and all of these folks. And here is a little information about one of them.
Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocer in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Yes, here we are in the kitchen. It's been a rainy week, a rainy time last week, but this week is a beautiful, beautiful summer week. Some parts of Iowa got a little bit more rain than necessary, and everything is green and growing. The weeds are doing beautifully.
I have a beautiful garden of weeds.
Oh, kind of nice to know that it does that in the summer. As opposed to the winter, now we've got green instead of white. And speaking of colors, orange. There was an amazing orange moon last night.
I saw it. It was like a big polka dot in the sky. Why was it orange?
I have no idea. It was kind of misty out there. So maybe
it was very unusual.
Very, very orange. It's not quite full. I believe the full moon comes on the 1st of July. But it was big enough to look like
it. It looked pretty round, but you're right. It's just under.
A big, fat, orange moon. And another color, green. It's the 4th of July, and the corn is way beyond knee-high. We are starting to get buried in those wonderful corn crops. The corn is looking absolutely gorgeous. 4th of July is coming up this weekend. Thinking about
red, white, and blue.
Red and blue. We're going to be talking about berries this week, and we're going to talk about an herb of the week. And Donna will talk to a young man from Ames that has made his way to a fancy premier restaurant in New York City. First, let's consider some red, white, and blue. There's all kinds of red things to eat and blue things to eat. And, well, Donna, you ran across a really interesting recipe that celebrates all those colors.
Yeah, there's a little 4th of July special here. It's made with shaved ice. Now, I'm looking at this and thinking maybe I'm going to invest in one of those little shaved ice machines. There are many ranging from, I think the website said $28 all the way up to quite expensive, but it looks like a fun, low-calorie summer option. So this recipe was to get your shaved ice machine and refrigerate some glasses.
We're talking snow cones at home.
Adult here, snow cones.
Yes, very good.
So this had three layers of color, and of course the bottom one was the blue, and that was the recipe is you take a pint of blueberries, 2 tablespoons of cassis, which is actually black currant liquor, a couple of tablespoons of sugar, and some lemon juice, and you just kind of munch it all together either in the blender or something like that. So you put that one on the bottom with the shaved ice. Then the middle layer, which is white, is a little thicker, so it keeps the blue and the red from commingling. And that was banana coconut milk. So you take a 14-ounce can of coconut milk and 3, they say, overripe bananas. You want them really, really sweet. Put them in the blender and mush those up. And that makes your second layer. And then on top of that, you add more shaved ice and you put in strawberries with a little sugar, you know, so they juice out. And this recipe had a little orange blossom water in the strawberries, which sounds good. So you've got your red, white, and blue, bing, bang, bong.
Well,
healthy, not too many calories, and easy to do.
Good. If people would like to find this recipe, give them the website that they can go by.
Oh, boy, this is on tastingtable.com. And the title is Chip Off the Old Block, Make a Red, White, and Blue Shave Ice for the 4th of July.
Good.
So tastingtable.com.
Good. Another thing that is kind of jumping into ripeness this time of year is all kinds of berries. And I'd like to take a little minute here to talk about elderberries. Elderberries. They are a very, very hardy, grow almost any place. Bush that grows in Iowa in road ditches.
And they get big.
Mine are big.
Maybe 10 or 12 feet tall.
One of those things that's so healthy and so good for you, and they take care of themselves. They grow wild, and we forget that this sort of thing grows wild. You can make wonderful things out of elderberries. You can just use the juice. I love making elderberry jelly. You can use the blossoms.
Well, we're in the blossom season right now, actually towards the end of it. They're really pretty. They're called umbrellas.
Yeah, like
because
umbrella.
They look like little flower umbrellas.
Mm-hmm. And so if you see these bushes on the side of the road with these beautiful multi-blossomed fuzzy things, white, gorgeous things.
Now, they're not hydrangeas.
Different thing altogether.
Okay, elderberries are taller.
Yes, and have...
And wild.
Yes, and have very pointed multiple leaves. And one can... I've heard of actually frying these blossoms. I have never done that.
Me either.
That sounds pretty, pretty exotic.
Sounds a little fussy to me. I don't need, you know, they're so delicate.
But the blossoms also have a very unique, delicate taste. So you can infuse those blossoms in things.
Isn't Joe doing some elderberry infusion?
Oh, my husband got on the internet and got all excited.
So tell us what he's doing. You have any idea?
Well, like you talked about the black currant
leaf
cordial.
Uh-huh.
This is putting elderberry blossoms, infusing it
straight
in some
into vodka.
Yes,
and
yes.
That's it. Sugar or no?
Knowing him, I'm sure he didn't put any sugar, but I think he did put a little lemon juice in with, or lemon peel.
Uh-huh.
And it's supposed to sit for a while, and that smell comes out. You wouldn't think these delicate little flowers would do anything, but there they are. They are
gorgeous.
Well, there
is that Saint Germain elder blossom liqueur, which has become
very popular
recently. It is delicious, especially as an addition to cocktails. So,
very good. Well, I mentioned jelly and the berries come out, and you can harvest a whole lot. That's one nice thing about elderberries. You can get quantities with a scissors and a pair of some clothes that you don't mind getting purple and going through the brush a little bit for. But they don't have thorns. They don't have, so that's good. I have a little bit of thing I want to read for you here. Thanks to Mark Edwards for passing along this book. I'm borrowing it from him. It's called The Global Forest by Diana Beresford Kroger. And she writes about, she loves trees. She loves forests. And she writes beautifully about trees and forests. Here's a little bit about elderberries. And she puts it in a category, a little chapter here about magical trees. Magical trees and mystical forests are as old as Father Time. Magic is known and recognized worldwide, both in the past and in the present. The word itself is very old and arises with the birth of civilization. It comes from the old Persian word magus, meaning sorcerer. Some trees of our global garden fit the bill of being magical. One of these is the elderberry. Sambucus is its name. It has long been considered to hold magic. This knowledge was held parallel in time by different cultures of old and new worlds. It was known in China, Japan, as well as Russia. The elderberry was a favorite in the heady days of Egyptians and remained in continuous use to modern times. In Northern Europe, many people would never pass an elderberry without greeting the tree, either in word or deed. They would doff their hat and bow in respect. The species was never burned or never destroyed because it was believed that the souls who lived in an elderberry bush would then be destroyed. It did not go unnoticed that the elderberry is never touched by insects or destroyed by disease. The elderberry does have extraordinary powers. In ancient Egypt, it was used as a valuable cosmetic. Its effects on the skin are rejuvenation and revitalization. The flowers were popular as an infusion for an eye lotion and to rejuvenate weary eyes. Native American peoples used the elderberry on their premature and newborn babies. These babies were washed in a lukewarm water of which, you get this, dried elderberry flowers had been soaked.
Oh, the flowers.
The flowers. The warm waters contain capillary protective biochemicals that act as a gentle skin tonic through vasodilation on the newborn skin. And probably one of the most important biochemicals is in the mature black fruit of the elderberry is a rhamnose sugar complex. It increases the efficiency of the metabolism of the eye, particularly the avian eye, adding visual acuity in the transition zones between dark and light.
Yes, the birds do eat the elderberry.
That's it.
Not the insects, but the birds.
That's why. The sugar is much sought after by songbirds in their north to south migrations in the global garden. And this elderberry was often called the medicine chest of country people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because like I mentioned before, the water is good for the eye. Elderflower water is good for the complexion and the eyes. And the flowers are also used to treat burns and bruises. And the berries are rich in vitamin C and for centuries have been used for jellies, cordials, wines.
It's also a cold remedy. Like yes. You can buy Sambucol at the drugstore or at the health food store. That's elderberry syrup for colds.
Very good. So doff your hat to the next time you pass an elderberry bush.
Well, we're going to get into the season for the berries pretty soon. And they do have a beautiful color. However, the taste is a little metallic. So when you make elderberry jelly, what are you putting with it?
Oh, always put some lemon juice in for sure. You have to temper elderberry with lemon juice. But I also like to mix it with apple or some other.
I've done it with plums,
yes,
with raspberry.
Add
any acidic fruit
yes.
will kind of
wake
perk it up.
Yeah. Wake it up, yes. Yes, good. Well, another thing I did over the weekend, besides look at elderberry blossoms and doff my hat to the bush, there is a series of concerts happening at the Prairie Moon Winery just north of Ames, and I happen to take one in. I'll have you know that our fine engineer, Rick Morrison, was there, and he recorded the concert that I listened to, and that concert will be upcoming sometime here on your very own community radio station. The band that we heard was Finders and Youngberg. Now, Finders and Youngberg is a bluegrass band. I know it sounds like a law firm, but really, truly, Finders and Youngberg is a bluegrass band. And I do enjoy the music. Mike Finders, who's kind of the lead guy and plays guitar and writes all the words, he's an Iowa native. He grew up in Marshalltown, but the band is currently housed in Fort Collins, Colorado, I believe. Five fine musicians. Blue, as in red, white, and blue. It's a 4th of July thing, too. Bluegrass tends to be the kind of music that talks about broken hearts and things gone wrong and people always complaining about things. But Mike writes some better tunes, too, that I think have a little bit more oomph to them. We're going to hear a tune here about food. He wrote a great tune about his mama's cooking.
I was an easy rider till I hit that hard road. Started out light and breezy, but I since piled on a heavy load. Never lost and lonely, but now I pace it slow. I was a young punk, full of spunk, and I walked.
This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a little song about Mama's Cookin' by the band Finders and Youngberg. We just made a educational discovery here. Our engineer, Rick Morrison, said the reason that the moon was so orange last night was a major forest fire in Canada. And so we were seeing the moon through dust and smoke.
Canadian
and
smoke.
Oh, so there you go. You heard it first here on the Donna Lana Kitchen. Such things happen. Yes, we're part of a big, big world. And that affected our viewing of the moon. I want to mention, you are listening to KHOI, Radio for the Heart of Iowa, FM 89.1. If you want to find out more about KHOI, go to the website, khoifm.org. Things are streamed there. You can listen to us any old time via your electronic device. Things are streamed. And also, the Donna Lana Kitchen has a website there that will bring you all sorts of good things. Recipes. We've got it's actually a new and improved website, and you can find your way around it very nicely. We have old shows. We have recipes. There's a couple of videos there. There's a great picture or two of Donna and I. So look up that and do support this fine radio station. So Donna has been away on a food adventure, but she is back. Now tell us where you've been.
Well, I went to Stone Barns and the Blue Hill Restaurant at Stone Barns, which is just north of New York City in Pontico. And it is the old Rockefeller estate, you know, at the turn of last century, sort of the ultra wealthy all maintained kind of show farms. And this was a big dairy farm. And it's called Stone Barns because the barns are made out of stone. So when I was there with Fred Kirschman and Carolyn Raffensperger, also Ames residents, and Fred is the president of the board at Stone Barns, so it was quite a treat to go with Fred there. A young man was behind the bar, and he mentioned that he's also from Ames, and his name is Peter Beekler.
Who would have thought?
So here we are, a nice young man making it big in the world, and Peter's job is there. First of all, he's just graduated from the Cornell School of Restaurant Management, which is a big deal. It's probably one of the best professional schools in the world, and he is a sort of front of the house person at Stone Barns, which means he manages food and beverage, can serve at the bar, can be a maitre d'. There's service there is excellent, so there's lots of people kind of rushing around taking care of your every little desire. And so I said to Peter, "Well, the next time you're home, let's have you on the radio to talk about Stone Barns food." And lo and behold, he was here just this weekend. And so we had a little dinner party at my house last night, and we recorded an interview with Peter Beekler.
Good. Let's hear what we heard last night.
I was at Stone Barns last week having dinner in New York, near New York City. And it's sort of like the mecca of all things culinary. Certainly in this country and perhaps globally. That's where Dan Barber is the chef, and they kind of have their own 80-acre farm, and they produce marvels at the table. Mm-hmm. So when I was there, I met Peter, who was behind the bar that night, and he told me he came from near Ames, and I said, "Well, the next time you're in town, we got to have you on the radio." So it turns out it's this week. So here is Peter. Welcome from home from Stone Barns.
Thank you. It's good to be back in Iowa. I don't get here very often, so it's nice to come home every once in a while. So.
Yeah. We were going to talk about what we ate that night.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you have a better idea than I do because you can tell about other things that they make. I'm sure is it different every night?
It is different every night. So the concept of the restaurant is truly to take what is freshest. I guess what Chef Dan likes to say is that we've moved beyond the farm-to-table movement. We've moved to the farmer movement, really supporting the farmer, what the farmer's growing, and molding our cuisine to what's available from the farm rather than demanding things from a farmer, a really important distinction in farm-to-table.
So, well, it's sort of like here. Whatever Lana is growing, that's what I cook.
Exactly, and that's what it used to be for a very long time, that whatever was growing out in the field or in the trees or out in the forests even, that's what you cooked, and that was the cuisine of the region. You know, Creole cooking or Cajun cooking is kind of the epitome of a local cuisine.
Well, here's the deal with Stone Barns, though. To get back to that realness, you have to be able to go and what's a meal? It's about $200 plus the wine pairing.
It is. It is a bit in the northern range for for a meal. But I think what people need to realize about that is that the food that we're growing is expensive. The labor to take care of that farm and to take care of all that land is expensive. And people need to realize that food, sustainably grown food, is expensive, but it's worth it.
Well, it is. It's really, it's a presentation. It's an entertainment. It's an education. It's, you must have a lot of fun working there.
I do. I don't think I've ever studied more than how much I study at work. Mm-hmm. And I went to college for 4 years, but
Peter just graduated from the Cornell, what's it called?
School of Hotel Administration. So,
which is absolutely one of the best in the world. So
yeah. Well, Switzerland doesn't like to say so.
Oh, but if you're saying that you're actually learning more at Stone Barns, this is why people pay that amount of money, because really do. Well, let's describe a little bit. Like, the first course was this piece of wood, okay? And they bring out this, I don't know, it's maybe an 8 or 9 inch long piece of wood with spikes sticking out of it.
We call it the fence back in the kitchen. We don't call it the fence at the table, but back in the kitchen we call it the fence because it looks like a picket fence.
Kind of, but it's only the upper parts. Yeah. You know? So, and skewered on it are these minuscule, like, teeny weeny heads of lettuce or a tiny little radish with the leaves and the root on it. And each one has been dipped in some kind of different, very light vinaigrette. Yes.
We like to accentuate, and Chef Dan always makes that the very first thing that people eat during their meal.
There's a term in French called amuse-bouche,
yes,
which means kind of amusing the mouth. Mm-hmm. And it's usually small bites, and it often comes before the meal. But I have to say, almost the whole meal was like a series of amuse-bouches.
Yes, yeah. And that's what we want to do. You know, when you're doing a 12-course, 14-course tasting menu, yeah, you can't have gigantic courses. Otherwise, people are stumbling out of the restaurant completely full, you know. So we do have smaller portion sizes, but you really get to see the gamut of what the farm is producing. So we really like to emphasize the diversity that the farm is producing.
At the moment.
So,
you go in and you sit down. They don't bring you a menu, except the cocktail menu, which was delightful.
Yeah.
But they say, the waiter comes and says, are there any things that you don't like to eat or don't eat or are allergic to? And you say, we of course, all three of us said, oh, no, we love everything. Right. And then after that, they just bring...
It's just a parade of food.
After right. They that, choose so. In the kitchen what you want. Tell us about the needle in the haystack.
Needle in the haystack.
Another course.
Yeah. It's another one of our jokes that we like to play with the guests a little bit. We have this bowl that comes out with a big pile of hay in it.
It was a rock. Mine was on a piece of slate.
There's
a lot of natural rock with a pile of hay on it.
So we use a rock with this pile of hay on it. Very fragrant. You know, it's walking through the dining room. Different
it's
smells.
Like new mown grass. Yeah, sort of, but it's dried.
But it's dried. And we have these little tiny Christini sticks in there.
I'm not kidding. They are tiny. They're like the size of a matchstick. A wooden matchstick, basically. And they're just poking into the hay.
Yeah, when you were there, it was made with cheese and ramps. It's a game we like to play with our guests, because we have them just pick through the haystack looking for these little needles of goodness. And it's always fun to just watch them just tear apart that hay and find all of the...
See, it's like a floor show on the table, really.
Yeah, it's hilarious. And, you know, we're very high-end dining. We like to, like, white tablecloth and everything. And we have all of these guests who always apologize to the waiters that they're making messes on their table.
Yes, the hay fell off the plate. Oh,
you know, they're always apologizing about it. And we're like, no, it's perfectly fine. We want you to do this. We want you to be interactive with your food. And I mean, that's the part of it. Farms are interactive and the food is interactive. So it just all fits together as one.
There was another course, which was also on a piece of wood with some more metal sticking. This one had this one did look like a fence. Okay. And strung through the fence was a baby cucumber vine.
Yes.
So you actually got the vine with the baby cucumbers and they were all like an inch or less. That's a course. You just pick the cucumber off the vine and you eat it.
And I don't know if you noticed, but later on, we used that cucumber vine from your course, from that course in a different course. You got the cucumbers, so the compressed cucumbers that we cooked with, I guess, sous vide with a little bit of basil and dill and other herbs with the halibut cream. There was a nice, that baby vine that you saw.
So you used the leaves from the...
Yeah, we blanched them real quick and we...
My leaves went into my dish?
Yes, your leaves that you from earlier. Oh my goodness,
that is beyond complicated.
It's the kitchen is a busy place. A lot of things, a lot of moving parts to keep track of.
Oh, but that's, you should have told me. I would have flipped out right on the spot. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So there were multiple courses. There was, a liver pate. What kind of liver do you think it was?
We used pork liver for
that. It was pork liver.
So Stone Barns pork liver.
Okay, but on this little sliver of liver on the plate, right, was pressed into it was chocolate.
Chocolate.
Now, how did he do that?
So they just take, it's a very, I would call it a kind of a bitter, kind of more savory chocolate.
Oh, yeah, definitely dark.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So they take a dark chocolate and they make this kind of crackled.
I wondered if it was almost like a sugar, a brittle.
Exactly.
With lots of chocolate.
Yeah.
I thought about that.
So they just kind of make a brittle of it, very, very thin, and they crack little pieces
and
of it.
And then they press
put it
inside
to make like a little liver sandwich, you know,
well,
between
chocolate. Well, because tonight, I kind of figured that's what they had done in... So I often make liver pate for Fred because he loves liver. Mm-hmm. And so I made the pate tonight, but I didn't want to try to make the chocolate crackle because I wasn't, you know, I only had one bite of it and it was dark and I wasn't really sure. So I was waiting to ask you. But what I did was I often put a gelée on the top of my, so I thought, okay, I'm going to make the gelée with a bitter chocolate in it. So at least we did work the chocolate into it.
It
worked, didn't it?
It worked. It's definitely, I mean, liver and chocolate, we always like to tell our guests, liver and chocolate is a natural pairing.
Bitter chocolate.
Bitter chocolate.
It is. It works very well. Let's see, what else did we have that night? Well, there were some homemade sausages.
Yes.
Like dry cured.
Yes.
And so you're doing all the charcuterie in the kitchen.
All our charcuterie is done by our vice president of culinary, Adam Kay. He's in charge of our preservation program at Blue Hill. So that includes charcuterie. It includes his vegetable preservations. He's doing some amazing things with pickling and fermenting.
Oh, yeah, we had various pickles on various plates.
And that's the amazing part about Blue Hill for me. A lot of people love to come to the restaurant in the height of the summer. I would say go in the middle of winter. You really get to see the chef's
very,
skills.
Very, more complex in the winter.
More complex in the winter.
No baby cucumbers.
Exactly. You're not relying on these beautiful tomatoes that have taste out of this world. It's really showcasing what chefs can do with fresh ingredients from the summer and how they can keep those ingredients and you know, use them throughout the entire year. So really keeping to that. I guess it's not fresh vegetables, but it's still using...
Certainly local. Yeah,
certainly local.
And preservation is really important.
It's very important.
Part of any cuisine, actually.
Yes.
Especially ones that have big seasonal swings.
Exactly.
You know? The other thing I had, which was really, really amusing, was a single udder butter. I like that. Single udder butter.
Yeah, so single udder butter is an idea that Chef Dan came up with after he has a farm in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The restaurant's
called
Blue Hill Farm. Yeah.
Yeah,
so the restaurant is named after his farm.
And this was his grandmother's farm.
His grandmother's farm. And he and his brother decided to take it back to a dairy farm after many, many years of it being partially beef and then it just being fallow for many years. So they took it back to the tradition of it being a dairy farm. Sean Stanton, the farmer who's up at Blue Hill Farm, had Dan start tasting the different milks from the different cows. All cows have different milk based on their breed, based on the grasses that they eat, based on many things. So the idea for single udder butter came from the different tastes of the different milks from the different cows. So single udder butter may come from Jillian, it may come from Daffodil.
I had Daffodil, I can't remember the other one that night, but they tell you the name of each little piece of butter. Yeah, and this is Daffodil's butter, and this is Jillian's butter.
And we have a biography of every one of the cows, so... It's kind of like a, you know, the biography of, you know, Jillian, and Jillian's our most famous. She's been there the longest, and she's kind of the matriarch of the herd. But
what breed is Jillian?
She's a Dutch belted. So
a Dutch belted.
Yeah. So it's really fun to talk to the guests about just the different, you know, cows have different personalities and they eat different grasses. So it's fun to talk to the guests about that and. To translate that story into what they're eating is really the best part about work. There are about 45 people in the kitchen every night.
And which the kitchen is what, maybe 20 by 40 at the most or something? I mean, it's not huge.
Not huge.
And very complex.
Yes, very complex. Many lines for, you know, we have the garde manger, we have the fish line, we have the meat line, we have the amuse line, we have... private dining, so it's just, you know, all these working parts, and not one line is responsible for one dish. You know, since we use a lot of vegetables in our dishes, there's a lot of, you know, garde manger, we need this for this meat dish, and, you know, it's very complex, and they all do a wonderful job, and
it's kind of like an orchestra.
Yeah, it really is. You know, we've got Chef Dan up there, you know, making sure that everything's coming together.
Conducting.
Yeah,
yes.
Conducting, making sure everything's coming together. I kind of stay out of the kitchen.
Oh, good for you.
I tried my hand at cooking in professional kitchens while I was at Cornell. I'm much more of a front of house person, much more.
Oh, good. You don't like to carry sharp objects and play with fire?
It's fun sometimes, but that pressure, you know. The front of house has a different pressure.
To look really smooth in the front of the house, right?
Yeah. Back of house, it's a bit intense.
It's hot. It's also very hot. Very hot in the kitchen. Yeah.
A bit intense. So my strengths, I found out were more in the front of house. I interned there 4 years ago for them while I was still in school, and I did some work with Chef Adam. Up in the charcuterie kitchen, and I got to see some of those things.
That's a little less pressure, right?
And kind of interesting. I mean, just very fascinating to watch.
You got to work with time on that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the only thing I've done in the kitchen, pretty much. But I guess my favorite part of the meal or being there is really watching the reactions that people have to, you know, the simplicity of some of the dishes that we have. I mean,
oh yeah, this is New York, folks. Yes. How do they like that cucumber vine? Exactly.
Well, I mean, that's also, you know, watching some of these people come from Manhattan is pretty hilarious, you know, to watch them come out and to look at the farm and to taste this cuisine. It's something that I kind of took for granted growing up in Iowa and growing up on a farm in Iowa. A lot of these people have never touched a cow before, have never looked at a sheep before, like seen it that close.
Yeah,
you know,
didn't know that the eggs come in with the rear end of the chicken.
Yeah, so it's really kind of hilarious to interact with some of these guests and the awe factor that they have with something as simple as, I mean, I think we served you the cherry tomatoes on the vine with honey and smoked goat cheese. And that's one of the guests' favorites. They're like, this is so simple. It's like, yeah, you don't need to do much to a really delicious cherry tomato. And I think we do a really good job of balancing letting food shine when it can shine, but then also complementing it.
Plus the setting. We didn't even talk about what Stone Barns is. It's just awesome. It is the Rockefeller family farm.
Yes.
And back in the day when very wealthy people had mega farms with show cattle and things like that. So this was the dairy barn,
I
believe?
Yeah, the dairy barn.
And it's called Stone Barns because it is a very big, beautiful piece of stonework.
Yeah. So it's a Normandy-style dairy barn. So
But the stalls are all gone.
Yeah, all the stalls are gone. So the dining room, where the diners actually are, that's actually the milking parlor. So
It's the biggest part of the... Yeah.
When my dad came out to visit me, he was a little disappointed that there weren't milking cows in the milking parlor. So
we miss that. Yes, yeah. We missed that part. Yeah.
He was kind of confused why there's people dining in a milking parlor. It didn't make too much sense to him, but it is a beautiful setting. The dining, or all the diners who in the dining room looks out over our 8-acre field, which the sun sets behind every single night for right before dinner service. So people are just, they're just blown away by the setting. It's very pastoral. It's a really big thing that we do for our guests is move them for one of the courses throughout the night. We like to kind of move our guests to other parts of the restaurant to highlight other aspects of the beautiful architecture that's there. We move them to the manure shed sometimes. That's my personal favorite.
Sans manure.
Right. There is a composting bin in there, like a finished compost bin in there. So it's got this intense earthy smell. And we usually do some kind of...
It is theatrical.
Some kind of mushroom course in there so that people, you know, they got the earthy smell of the compost. You got the mushrooms. It's very sensory feeling in there. And then we have some of our guests get to go into the kitchen and have a meal in the chaos of the kitchen, the orchestrated chaos, I should say, of the kitchen. So our guests love it. They just, sometimes we get a little bit of grumbling. Oh, I don't want to leave my table. Like, this, we're having such a nice time.
Yeah.
But as soon as they get to that new space, they're just kind of blown away by...
And it's so popular, even at these really high prices. Mm-hmm. How long does it take to get a reservation?
Our reservation books open up 60 days in advance. So any day that you call, you can book 60 days out. We always get calls, though, for people, can I book, you know, 6 months in advance or, you know, a year in advance? And we're like, no, we really, like, 60 days out, like... So we'll have people like put it on their calendar to like call Stone Barn, like call Blue Hill on this day and look for a reservation. So it's, and we're fortunate that we just won two very major awards. We won the James Beard Award for Outstanding Restaurant for 2015, which we're very excited about. And then we just got on to San Pellegrino's 50 Best Restaurants in the World. So We're very excited about these awards.
It's quite significant.
Yeah. So, and it's amazing. You know, Blue Hill at Stone Barns has been around for 11 years, and we're now seeing all of these awards coming in and this recognition, I think in part due to the farm-to-table movement being such a prominent aspect of the food world right now.
Yeah, when Dan Barber was here, he did refer to himself as sort of the poster child for the farm-to-table movement. It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
So, okay, we got one course left to talk about, Peter.
Okay.
The dessert. I love this. Yeah. So I replicated it tonight, I'm very proud to say. It was a black currant leaf. Not the black currant berry, the black currant leaf. Not the red currant, only the black currant leaf has this. So it was a black currant leaf gelato.
Mm-hmm.
So the basic recipe is take a bunch of black currant leaves, preferably the smaller, fresher ones, and you steep them in the milk and cream. And, you know, I actually steep them, then I let them sit overnight in the refrigerator, and then I strain them off the next day. Mm-hmm. And I really pressed the leaves to get as much out of it as I could. Then I added the eggs and the sugar to make the cream to put into the ice cream processor. Of course, the presentation there was extraordinary. And I have to say, you're going to tell me how he did it.
Yes.
The ice cream was served, the little ball of ice cream was served in a small basket of leaves. Now, I thought it was a black currant leaf.
It is a black currant.
It is. So, but they were dried and formed into a basket. So, so I can do it next time.
So what Chef Bobby, who is our pastry chef at Blue Hill, he takes these black currant leaves. I think he soaks them in a little bit of water just to make sure they don't dry out too much in the oven. And he makes a basket out of them. But he forms this basket over a pile of strawberries.
I know, they were on top, but...
Yeah.
So the actual shape of the basket is...
It's formed around strawberries. So then he takes that basket, and he roasts it in the oven. So
he's not roasting the strawberries.
He is. So the concentrating the sugars of the strawberries...
So it's a kind of a way of... They're almost like jelly, then, kind of.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. So, and then... Huh. And then just a little dollop of the black currant leaf ice cream on top, or
and then the and the strawberries go back on the ice cream.
Yeah.
So, all right, low temperature. Any idea how
long?
Yeah,
lower temperature. I'm not sure how long. I can get back to you. But, so he has the baskets. He has the leaves or the baskets ready, and then as soon as we fire dessert, he pops it into the oven for a little bit, and then comes out.
So they
piping hot and.
The baskets are already cooked or not already cooked?
Not already cooked. So he's already got the baskets made.
So it must go pretty quickly then.
Yeah. So it might be a higher temperature.
How does he make them? Does he weave the leaves together? Or
he ties. He ties with the twine.
Well, I didn't try and eat the basket, so I didn't find any string.
Yeah. He cuts open the string and then opens up the basket, and then you have this nice little basket with the strawberries inside.
Oh. Well, if they let you in the kitchen, take pictures and send them.
Yeah.
It's... We do have the black currant leaves here.
But the menu's changing constantly, Donna, so I don't know how long the black currant leaf basket's gonna be around. So.
Well, the black currants are actually just ripening now.
Yeah, so.
And the strawberries are probably coming to an end.
They're pretty much coming to an end.
Yeah.
Chef Bobby's really working with cucumber.
For dessert?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's cucumber sorbet with this Japanese goat cheesecake.
Hmm. I'll have to track that one down. I think I saw a recipe like that. Actually, I'll find it and we'll talk about it on air. Yes!
Yes.
Oh, it was really good. It was fabulous. And I hope you have so much fun working there all the time.
I will. It's a pleasure to work there, and I'm happy that I'm back there, you know, working with such a great team, both front of house and back of house, and the farmers. We couldn't do a lot of what we do at Blue Hill without the farmers who work with us. So
this is Peter Buechler, one of our own Iowa boys from which town? Gilbert? Are you really from Gilbert? Or
our address is technically Ames, but we have a Story City phone number.
Hometown boy makes good at Stone Barns.
Yeah.
So, and through our hometown boy, we may get an inside track into more of the recipes. So, Peter, don't hesitate to keep us posted, because Fred always tells me about the politics of what's going on there, but I have no idea what they're eating. So so now we've got it all covered. So thank you very much, Peter, and enjoy your good life at Stone Barns.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Come back to Iowa often.
So that was Peter Buechler, an Iowa boy, telling us about life in the big city. And next week, we're going to have an interview with his brother, Joseph Buechler, with Fred Kirschman, talking about carbon sequestration. Joseph is an agronomist at Finca Nueva in Costa Rica, where they are studying how to capture carbon out of the air and put it back into the soil, and why that could save us all from annihilating the planet in a blaze of too much carbon.
Right. Important work.
So that's next week. Peter's older brother, Joseph Buechler, will be on the show.
Good. You are listening to KHOI 89.1 FM, Radio for the Heart of Iowa. This is community radio. I want to talk about an herb of the week. Everybody needs an herb of the week. We're going to talk about bergamot. Bee balm today. And also, this is a little shout out, an acknowledgement of a get well wish to Helen Gunderson, who had a little kerfuffle with her bicycle recently. And she and I were emailing back and forth about bergamot and bee balm, and so I sort of looked up things about it. Bee balm is a wonderful garden plant. It's a hot weather thing. It's actually a native prairie plant. The Latin name for it is Monarda Didyma, bergamot, bee balm. This North American native became a popular garden plant in Europe after settlers brought it back to Europe from the New World. The name Monarda in this name honors the Spanish medical botanist Dr. Nicolas Mondaris of Seville, Spain, who wrote his herbal compendium on the flora of America in 1569. He probably called this herb bergamot because its leaf scent resembles that of the small, bitter Italian bergamot orange.
Which is what is in Earl Grey tea. That's the most common flavor of bergamot that we all know about.
Yes, that taste. The bergamot herb, the flower, has that same sort of taste or aroma, too. It's used in aromatherapy, perfumes, cosmetics. Native Americans use it as a drink. And it was a popular tea substitute in New England after the Boston Tea Party in 1773. It's used for colds, bronchial complaints, and it contains a powerful antiseptic, thymol. So.
And they're beautiful. I just love them in the garden, purple and red. Purple is, I think, more common, but, boy, the red is just gorgeous.
Yes. And here's a little thing about bergamot. It's called bee balm, but and it does attract bumblebees, those big, big, heavy, buzzy bees. But honeybees are unable to reach the nectar in bee balm unless holes have been made by other insects. So those insects have to work together out there for honeybees to actually enjoy that. You can also use the flowers as a edible flower in a salad. And to make tea, you can infuse it in hot water for a while, or you can simmer it gently for 10 minutes.
This is the leaves, right?
The leaves. And you can use it. It sort of makes an Earl Grey sort of flavor. You may want to add a little bit of black tea, too. And you can use it in wine and lemonade. So enjoy. That's Bee Balm, Herb of the Week.
And they are blooming all over town now.
Yeah. So, Donna, I wanted to ask you about radicchio. We had a radicchio salad the other night. It's a new sort of thing to me. I asked Donna early in the year, so what should I grow in my garden this year? And Donna said, some bitter greens. Tell me about bitter greens.
Well, I have to say, by this time of year, even though we still have really good lettuce, which we will be losing as soon as it heats up, but I've been eating kind of baby lettuces and leaf lettuces all winter long because it's easy to grow in hothouses and stuff like that. And I'm getting a little tired of them by now. So we've been having all these lovely salads of bitter greens. So radicchio, endive, frizzy mustard greens, chicories also. You call them Italian dandelions.
Yes, I've grown Italian dandelion, which is a chicory, for quite a few years, because I've liked it as a cooked green. And just biting into it, any of these things in the field, in the garden, I think, my goodness, that will set you free. You kind of bite into that, and it's a little bitter, but you made a lovely salad out of this stuff.
Well, I mixed them. First of all, the radicchio has a it's starting to head up a little bit, although there's kind of loose-leaf radicchios and headed radicchios, and they all have some red to them, so they make a beautiful addition to the salad. So you kind of slice them thinly, so you're not getting, because it's a less delicate leaf in terms of chewability than lettuces. So you're kind of making like more like a chopped salad, and then I just dressed it with a good balsamic vinegar, some olive oil, a little salt and pepper. It's that simple.
Great. I learned from Peter Beekler, who also enjoyed this salad along with other things the other night. He said in Italy, chicories are from the family of chicories, which this stuff is originally from Italy, and it's a very site-specific sort of plant. So it takes on the characteristic of different kinds of places that it grows. So the plant itself can look very different. Some can be very headed, look very cabbagey. Some can be very leafy, very red, very purple, very green. The Italian dandelions, that kind of chicory, actually looks like a big, fat dandelion leaf. And the endive, at least the kind of endive that I grow, is very short and fluffy and frizzy. And also, I found a fine kind of mustard. I like growing all kinds of mustard.
Oh, your mustards are beautiful.
Yeah,
I bought a bouquet from your booth.
Yes.
Well, it was. It's a little grouping with the curly mustard, the frizzy mustard. It was just adorable.
Yeah.
And delicious.
I don't know who's breeding and selling seeds out there. They're doing a fine job of getting all kinds of different tastes out there. That mustards can be really assertive and really, really tangy, or now there's some milder mustards that are very nice. I grow a kind called tender green, and it's very, very mild mustard, a big, flat, very gentle, very soft leaf.
Delicious. Also, these can be used in stir fries.
Yes.
And some of them, if they head up, can actually be like sort of cut into halves or quarters with a little olive oil and salt and pepper on them and put on the grill and cooked lightly.
Yes, because it's a green vegetable, but it has a little bit of body to
it.
Yeah,
it's more sturdy than lettuce.
Right, right. So find radicchio. It's called radicchio. It's called chicory. Look for endive. What was that other word? Oh, escarole is also in that family.
Mm-hmm,
again,
mm-hmm.
Very different looking sort of plants, all worth a nibble, all worth a taste.
And they will also, these are good fairly cold weather plants too. So into the fall, we'll get another round of them, I hope.
Yes, I plan on starting seedlings again probably, in a couple weeks because they love early spring, and they grew lovely. They grew great, but they're kind of heading out and coming to their fruition right about now. And
right.
I'll be picking all of those, and I'll start some so that you can have some in the fall and do start them yourself and try them in your garden. They're actually quite nice, and I'm going to keep experimenting with radicchio. Oh,
yum!
Always learning new things. That's very good. That's very good. Also, other things going on in the garden, like we mentioned, the weeds are doing very, very well. I was out pulling weeds and thinning things out, and oh my. If you grow okra, good time to thin out your okra. It grows better when it's got some room around those plants. Remember, things grow, they get big. Okra can get about waist high or chest high sometimes. So give it room. Yeah. Well, we've got the 4th of July weekend coming up. Hope you all have a dandy time. If you set off any of those fireworks sort of things, be extremely careful. Oh, I like to listen to fireworks from a distance,
now,
I guess.
I understand the Ames Municipal Fireworks are actually going to be on Friday night.
Yes,
is that correct?
Yes. Oh, and mention KHOI, I believe, will have a presence in the 4th of July parade, which is on Saturday. No farmers market this Saturday. There will be a parade instead. That's a good trade-off. So, yes, and there'll be things going on downtown after that. So wave and holler at the KHOI folks.
Well, there probably will be the North Grand Farmers Market.
Yeah, they probably will.
Yeah.
So look for some good food to eat. So support this radio station. You can contact us at khoiradio@gmail.com. And with that Gmail address, you can send us your thoughts. We'd like to hear from you. What's on your plate? Give us some ideas of what you'd like to hear us talk about. We'll go out with some more music by the Finders and Youngberg Band. This is a fine fiddle tune for all of us that have dogs that have been with us for a long time. This is called the Old Dog Waltz. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Virad Duwati. Good job, good job. Have a happy 4th of July, folks. Eat good food and enjoy life. Thank you.